Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Slam Hammer, an Australian Warhammer 40k and Kill Team podcast. My name is Will and I'll be your host for this episode, where we move on from some general overview of strategy and lists and tactics and stuff like that, and focus a bit more for this episode on the hobbying, converting and designing aspect of the hobby to achieve a desired aesthetic. Before we jump into the general overview of this episode, I just wanted to thank everybody who listened to and provided some feedback on episode 1. Episode 1 is also available on anchor.fm, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. For the first episode, there was a bit of a liberal use of the term stuff like that. I will try and keep that a little bit more under wraps as the season rolls on. And I would just really appreciate people's feedback on making sure that we're touching on aspects of the hobby which are outside of the tabletop, and to help people who are newer or less experienced in the hobby to enhance their skill set. And accordingly, this episode does focus on those more practical skills so that as hobbyists, we can achieve some great results. So in this episode, we'll be touching on designing a model to achieve a desired aesthetic and some of the tools and approaches to conversions and modeling to achieve those desired outcomes. If you do have your own projects or your own hobbying tips or any questions about anything that's in this podcast, do make sure you get in touch. There are a few different ways that you can reach us at this podcast. So the first is via the voice messaging link in the anchor.fm profile. You can also find us on Instagram at crossbladestudios@gmail.com, where a lot of the hobbying conversion work that I'll be doing for clients will appear up there, as well as a lot of the personal work I'm doing on my Death Watch and side projects, and also via email at crossbladestudios@gmail.com. And with that, we're going to slide into the first segment of episode 2, which focuses on designing a new model to reach a desired aesthetic. And we'll skip to that now. We'll see you after the break. So much like the nerdiest DMs ever, we're sliding back in to episode 2 to talk about designing a model to reach a desired aesthetic. One of the main questions I'm asked by people when I'm working on client work in a Warhammer store or on Instagram or by friends and colleagues and stuff like that in the course of conversations around modeling is, well, simply, how did you make that? I'm very proud to try and work on things very publicly and be very open and transparent about my iterative design process, because not only can I talk about something I'm really passionate about, but I can also hopefully educate some others about how they can achieve their own results, which are outstanding, because the better that we as a community do in propelling the hobby to high standards, the better it's going to be for everyone. And there's nothing wrong with a little bit of inspiration. So I do try to go to great lengths to explain not only the process I'm employing at that time, but also what I've basically done for the entirety of a design process and construction process, so that somebody can take that advice given on the spot, have a think about how they might be able to employ that in their own models, and as such that relates to the use of Warhammer 40k or Warhammer components, but also making use of resources out there such as third-party resellers and 3D printing services such as Shapeways to obtain parts that you wouldn't otherwise be able to get, either from Games Workshop in a way which is cost-effective, or from the kits you're working on. And I think the more that you can access these very bespoke parts to achieve a desired look, the better off you'll be. And a key example of that is Death Watch. The Death Watch Kill Team box comes with a number of chapter shoulder pads. And while the Index Astartes and the Space Marine range does allow for a lot of those shoulder pads to be used to represent different chapters, there is a limitation on how far that can stretch. So some of them, you know, might be able to be employed, for example, the Eagle shoulder pad as white and black consoles or Raptors and stuff like that. But beyond a very distinct number of examples, and another one being, of course, the Imperial Fists and the Crimson Fists, those shoulder pads can only stretch so far. So the range of shoulder pads which are available from Games Workshop as a seller of product is limited, and thus having a look at Forge World in the first instance, or to third-party sellers, or 3D printing services such as Shapeways are some good resorts for further customization that you might not be able to get directly off the shelf. And one of the really important things I thought I would do in the course of this episode is provide just a bit of a 101 on modeling, and this is going to start right back at the very start as a 101. So they're very, very basic, and that's designing a model to achieve a desired aesthetic. And you may have your own way of going about designing your models, but this is how I do it to achieve looks both for myself and for clients. And I start in a very abstract space thinking about the theme that underlies the model. And for my Death Watch, as I was explaining in episode one, there is a underlying story about the models representing some Death Watch Alpha teams that have recently returned from a fairly disastrous mission, and they're a bit scorned about the whole thing. So the model work is directed at making the Death Watch look a bit more grimdark than all bright and shiny and all that sort of thing. The reason for that is that I want them to come across as angry and dismissive of others and represent a faction that does not play well with others. And the idea for that really came from the Grey Knights relationship with the Space Wolves. The Grey Knights and the Space Wolves have been at odds in the past and have fought in the past. And we all know the Grey Knights will go to quite extreme ends to achieve their objectives. But at the end of the Armageddon campaign, the Space Wolves, for those who might not be aware, had a fairly open engagement with the Grey Knights to protect the civilians of Armageddon from summary execution and extermination. And Logan Grimnar played a significant role in that. And I think that that distrust and disdain for others kind of carried over to my Death Watch, because in Kill Team there is limited potential for mixing and matching your different factions, and you know, there, for those who are experienced with Kill Team, you'll know that mixing factions and swapping around keywords and stuff means that you might not be able to have a battle-hardened Kill Team and take advantage of all the strategies that might otherwise be available to your Kill Team, and the aesthetic and story then plays directly into that, because there's no mixing of my models in my Death Watch Kill Team as much as I have tinkered with the idea before. The only exception perhaps being a bit of an idea around mixing Death Watch and the Grey Knights to achieve a desired outcome, but there would be a significant handicap to employing them that way. So I haven't progressed to the building of any Grey Knights yet and the using of those Grey Knights and Death Watch together in a game, but who knows, that might eventually happen. So when you have a idea as to what you're looking for in a very abstract way, that might be, you know, the very tried and tested Space Marine, for example. Best example of those being something like the Imperial Fists or the Imperium's Good Boys and Poster Boys, the Ultramarines, then we can kind of think about what kind of character you want these models to exude. And for Kill Team, it gives you the variety there to do basically whatever you want, but the predominant theme I would suggest is that kill teams are made up of veterans, and the models in your kill team should represent veterans or those who have been awarded permission or scope to do these very special missions, and as such basically equip themselves in a way which allows for them to look and feel a little different to your rank and file. And the original kill team rules and summary in the old Space Marine Codex back in like 2004, I think, really focused on this as the foundation for all your modeling work that went into your kill teams, because they wanted all the kill teams that came out of this design process to be different and varied and not just represent another box of Eldar Guardians, for example. I think as a hobby and community, you can probably do a bit more than just the standard. And if you feel like doing the standard, that's fine too. But with such a small number of models, making them unique and special, particularly if they're going to take part in a broader narrative, is really important. So for my kill team, we've got the abstract, the Death Watch. They're a big angry group of veterans who have recently come back from a disastrous mission fighting the Necrons, and a lot of their number has been wiped out. And what that represents for me when it comes to a design is a bunch of models who They've got war gear, which represents each and every different kind of combination which I would ever need. And I mentioned this in the previous episode, so there's no reason why I would ever need to ally with anyone else, at least in most cases. I've considered whether there's limited scope for the Death Watch to ally with the Grey Knights to, again, kind of explore that concept which I mentioned. But the Death Watch, I have basically have every war gear combination that's available, so that if I ever need something on the field of battle, it's there. And a lot of the models have trophies to represent their individuality. So particularly in teams A and B, my models have their little shoulder icons or buckler shields, whatever you'd like to call them, representing either their chapter or personal heraldry. And each one of those is different. A lot of them at this early stage, while some of the models are still being built, are just their basic chapter color, but they will be expanded on in time to represent their personal heraldry. But also other trophies are important. So for example, on my Ultramarine, he's a Tyranid war veteran who just so happens to have found himself in the Death Watch. So he has trophies representing engagements with Tyranids. And my Black Templar is a rather disgruntled member of the Death Watch who came as a degree of penance because he thought he had visions of the Emperor on the eve of battle. And normally at that time, when a Black Templar has these visions, they present themselves to the masters of the chapter, and they petitioned to essentially take up the black mantle as the Emperor's champion. But this particular Marine had his visions at the same time as someone else, and the Grand Marshal of the Black Templars actually preferred the other guy. So we've got this scorned and angry Black Templar who thought he was going to be the Emperor's champion, and being a vainglorious and arrogant human fundamentally meant that he wanted to seek his glory somewhere else. So he referred himself to the Death Watch on his own initiative, and he's got his Storm Shield that he carries around as a veteran of the Black Templars on his back, and otherwise he carries his bolt gun and a power sword, and essentially, like the theoretical Black Shield, is seeking atonement for his past failures, and those failures have now been compounded to a degree, because he's been through this disastrous mission, one of his first missions with the Death Watch, and that's gone wrong too. So he's very gradually sort of skewing towards this very angry and bitter member of the Black Templars. And that's kind of represented in his appearance. And there are a number of ways in which that kind of plays into the traits that you can assign to your models in Kill Team, even though they don't really mean anything for the most part. I know there was an expansion of that recently in White Dwarf to kind of give you a bit more scope to have variation in your models' capacities to do damage and stuff like that, depending on how you're pushing your narrative. But for the most part, I just like modeling them to achieve a look that kind of suits what I want. And for me, that's just these really grim and angry individuals. The other side of the coin is the red shirts and new additions that I mentioned in the first episode. There are a number of newer additions to my Death Watch, and one comes from the Raven Guard. And Raven Guard, as people would probably appreciate, are the sneaky boys who probably benefit a bit more from being at range, particularly in mainline 40k, because of their bonuses that they get from being at a distance. And in Kill Team, that's represented in their chapter tactic by counting as obscured when you are a certain distance away from opposing models. And the idea was that this new guy has come in to replace casualties from this disastrous mission, and because there is a need to assign this new guy a mentor, normally this would go to the Ultramarine, who's the normal pinnacle of discipline and leadership, I guess. Sets an example for everyone else, even though he's not the squad sergeant. He's very much the moral and skills-based bench line that you go to. And this Ultramarine, who's also come out the other end of this disastrous mission, is just a vastly angry individual, because he was kind of caught up in the thick of it, and he might have entertained a bit of a disdain for Necrons at this point. So he's now armed with a Death Watch shotgun, and upon reaching the Death Watch, the idea is this new guy from the Raven Guard, he's like, "Hi, my name is Minno. I'm from the Raven Guard. My specialty is at range. I used to like to use bolt guns and sniper rifles, and my talent is being sneaky." And upon reaching the Death Watch, he turns up and he's assigned to this squad sergeant, who is a salamander. And the salamander goes, "Hey, you know what you'd really benefit from? A mentor." And the Dark Angel sergeant there kind of has a chat with the salamander and goes, "How about you stick him with the Ultramarine?" Because, of course, the Dark Angel doesn't want anything to do with the new guy, because he's got enough to focus on his own, of course, because they're off hunting the Fallen, and they're probably just, off reading books and burning candles a bit too closely to their faces, and they're far too solemn to take on the role of mentorship on their own. So and they go to this ultramarine and they say, hey, you're going to be the buddy for this new guy. And Raven Garden, you know, just kind of wanders over expecting a quite prim and proper ultramarine to be sitting there, and they just have this dark scowling ultramarine who's 100% done with being this disciplined and measured individual, and figures that working as a mentor gives him an opportunity to craft someone to be just as angry as him. So instead of giving the Raven Guard his bulk gun and saying, hey, we're gonna dally out at range and you're going to play to your strengths, he goes, you're the new guy, you get a shotgun, welcome to the Death Watch. And the whole thing now is that this ultramarine is mentoring the Raven Guard and doing the complete opposite of what he's there for. And the Raven Guard gets continually encouraged to kind of charge into the fray rather than be this standing back and shadowy figure who hides and does all sneaky stuff from long range. That's a bit of a overview of the story, and that kind of feeds into the aesthetic of my models. So as you can probably appreciate, the new guy to these alpha teams doesn't have all the trophies and extensive heraldry on him. He's pretty clean, whereas some of the others represent a grim and darker aspect of the Death Watch. But even so, like, the Raven Guard isn't necessarily going to be this bright and cheerful individual. He's now being thrown into the thick of skirmishes where he's not comfortable. So he's also developed this disdain and represents that same look, but without some of the additional detail that some of the others might have. And when I was going about this design process, I just started with a notepad and pen and sort of sketched down some ideas as to what I was looking to achieve. It may very well be that when you pick up a new Kill Team box, you just want to build what's in the box. And if that's for you, then fantastic. Absolutely go for it. But if you want to develop a strong narrative behind your models, I'd recommend just sitting there, sketching down some ideas, and designing a backstory which represents what you really want from your miniatures, rather than the limited backstory which the book could possibly give to you, because a name generator and some meaningless traits doesn't really say much, and it's a bit limiting as well. So I'd very strongly encourage that. And then when you take away these themes for your models, such as grim, dark, angry, frustrated, or, you know, like an ultramarine, less disciplined, then you can start thinking about how that would be represented on a model. So, for example, on the ultramarine, much like the Tyranid war veterans, he presents these trophies on his armor, such as a Tyranid claw, and also carries around one of the frag cannons sets of spare ammunition. And the reason why this guy carries the ammunition for the frag cannon rather than the new guy, as you would probably suggest if there's like an ammo runner or something like that, is because the ultramarine is also trying to influence the frag cannon eye in hand to get really deep into the fray as well. So he's offering to carry the ammunition so that they're both in the middle of the fray and causing a heap of damage. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways that these themes or ideas or concepts around personality are being presented on the model. So I spent about a day or two just sketching out both visually and in writing the kind of themes I wanted represented on each of my models. And then I came away and tried to match that up with the parts that I was finding both in the boxes that you get from Games Workshop, because, you know, there are some accessories that you get in the Primaris Intercessor boxes and stuff like that, which are great. Not so much on the Death Watch Kill Team box, though, which is a bit disappointing. And then kind of looking external to these boxes and saying, well, what do I need to fill these thematic gaps for my models? And then saying, well, okay, I'm going to go to a third-party seller and add something which is a bit more grim, like a particular head, to have a head swap, or a particular shoulder pad that looks a bit more ornate if you want your models to be a bit more ornate. And for me, there was going beyond that to Forge World bits and pieces from third-party sellers, because I wanted the old Ultramarines Horus Heresy models represented in my shotgunner. So a key example of that is the Ultramarines Praetorian helmets being represented in the Ultramarine, and then adding an antenna on the side if I wanted that Ultramarine to be the comms guy who would emphasize the strengths of the frag cannon with those bonuses that you get for employing him as a specialist of that nature. So that kind of represents the design philosophy I've employed. And for those thinking about doing the same, I would very strongly encourage having a look at what really appeals to you about 40K, whether or not that's just the general look. And if you look at a box of Ultramarines and go, hey, they look awesome, I'm going to build a bunch of really cool Ultramarines just with what I get in the box, then all the more power to you. But if you look beyond that to the lore or the art or to other hobbyists on places like Instagram or Facebook or other social media sites, and you see that, kind of like what I did with those Iron Hands Devastators, take note of those and think about how you can implement those in your own hobby, because there is such a vast world out there. I would hate for the hobby to be limited to what we see in boxes. And to a degree, the new sprues and how they're put together kind of represent a push to standardize. But I would absolutely encourage all hobbyists to do the complete opposite and design a model that works for you and matches exactly what you want. So take those external references, match them with the parts you're looking for, and if there isn't a part that you're looking for, have a strategy around getting to a desired aesthetic, and then writing all that down. And then when you've written all that down, there might be a whole bunch of models that you want to start first, and that's understandable. For me, I started with my Death Watch heavy weapons because they were probably going to be one of the harder things to design a harness for without using just exactly the same thing as this Russian dude did with his Iron Hands Devastators. So it took some time to figure out how I was going to do that, and I wanted to bowl that over first. But you know, if it just comes to picking a model and going, hey, I'm going to start with my Watch Sergeant or my Tyranid Lictor or something like that first, then you know, that's absolutely the most important thing, getting started, and then making sure you keep yourself accountable on progress too, because if you find yourself in a bit of a rut and unsure as to how to proceed, it can become really easy to dump that and go, well, this is all too hard. Maybe I should just start with something else, or maybe, you know, work on a different hobby project altogether. Not being dismayed by running into a roadblock, even if it's just a little bit of creative modeler's block, in inverted commas, is really important. So sticking to those ideas, pushing through challenges and asking for help as well to help you on that journey is really important. So that's the whole design philosophy conversation that I employ, and it's certainly one that I try to encourage my clients to use. And when clients come to me asking about how they can do something, I do like to walk them through that process so they understand what my thinking is as well, so they can get an idea as to what the journey is going to be. And then also, you know, keeping them updated with the progress of the model through whatever communication channel it is, and sending them progress photos and updates the entire way through the process, I think is really important. And we're going to take a break now, but when we come back, I'm going to jump to the hobbying basics, getting started with hobbying, converting and modeling. So we'll take a break now, and we will jump to hobbying and modeling just after this. So welcome back to Slam Hammer for this next segment, which is on the real basics of converting and hobbying and all that sort of thing. Before we begin, I just thought I'd make a clarification to the last segment on backstory. I just remembered that in between the design of this character, the Raven Guard to be this French sort of inspired individual, I actually decided that there wasn't enough of a Asian or Mongolian influence in my Death Guard. I do have a white scar, however, I thought it might be worth some expansion. So I actually changed that guy's name to Xiaodan Zha. So yes, if you do see a Raven Guard on my Instagram profile, Crossblade Studios, and you go, hey, he was called Minot in that backstory, that's why I kind of switched over. So thought I'd clarify that before continuing in case there's any confusion and I'm ever held to account about my lack of recall. So in this part of this episode, I figured I'd talk about just some of the real basics of going about converting and really building something entirely unique for yourself, and just running through some of the most important tools that you can have at your disposal to achieve that desired end. And I think, as I was mentioning in the last segment, probably the number one most important component, I think, is having a notepad and a pen or a pencil just to start sketching out what you're actually looking for in a model before you get started. The reason for that is having some direction in your conversions is often a good idea, and it does assist with, like I was saying, the theme that you're going for. And then also when you start matching the various pieces or components of your models to that project, it's handy to write down where you actually saw them if you're not storing bookmarks that you're extensively naming and categorizing in your browser, because you're bound to come over heaps depending on where you look in places like eBay or your third-party sellers. And actually keeping track of where you're finding these good things is really good. Or if you see a design reference on Instagram and you need to write down the name of the person who's the hobbyist on Instagram, and you can do that too, so you know exactly where you're going back to. So I think that if you're seeking inspiration or you're trying to develop your ideas and having a plan for going about a project, a notepad and pen is actually the most important. So that would certainly be my number one. And it might come across as quite obvious when you're talking about modeling and stuff like that, but the second most important tool I would say for a hobbyist is a really good value scalpel or hobby knife. And I use the XL brand of knife. And you can get these from any good hobby store or even from some art and craft stores that come with some surgical grade blades. And the reason for that is they're just really well balanced and effective for your miniature modeling. And while the blades do tend to break, I've always gotten quite a lot out of my XL blades, and this one that I'm looking at right now is actually due for replacement. They're actually incredibly useful, not only for the cutting and the trimming that you expect, but if you don't have a mold line remover using the back end of one of these to remove your mold lines, so your model is a bit more polished and finished, is a really good idea. And I actually use my scalpels for a bit of ad hoc crafting of plastic, depending on what I'm looking for. So if I need a really fine point to get into a space to scrape away some detail, I would actually use a scalpel before I use a file for that particular task. So having a really good scalpel available to do that with is really important. Thirdly, and perhaps as obviously, a good pair of clippers is indispensable to a hobbyist. The Citadel ones I use for plastic, sprue cutting, and they're absolutely fine for that purpose. They've never let me down. However, their construction is such that for metal, such as tin or copper, depending on what you're using, or even for pewter, if you're using old pewter models, they're not great for that, and they'll probably end up breaking quite quickly. So what I use for metals to trim those is a pair of heavy-duty clippers that I just bought from a hardware store. They're Trojan brand. They're nice and heavy. They've got a really good blade. And the reason why I use these clippers is not to achieve a fine edge, because you're not going to get it. The clippers of this variety have slanted edges, because a lot of the time they're used to trim electrical wires. They're actually used just to remove the large parts out of the way, and then using other tools to achieve the finer, more finished result that you're looking for. So, you know, these Trojan clippers might go in to clip a paper clip if I was going to pin a model with a pin vise, and that would be absolutely fine for that, because it doesn't matter if there's a rough edge on the end of a pin or a paper clip, but I would never use these to trim something from a sprue, because they can't get close enough to the model to remove sufficient flash. And while you can always clean up with a scalpel, I'd like to do things properly the first time, and having a flat-edged clipper for that is always going to be a bit better. And, you know, these Trojan clippers, while great for metals, are not great for plastics. So I wouldn't use that for that. Files and things like that to clean up your flash and your metals are also really great. I don't have a particular preference around files, but I do have a preference around the grain that you employ. And to me, the finer the grain, the better. The less fine the grain, the more rough the impact's going to be. And these are great when you're filing back large, rough surfaces. But at least if you account for increasing scale of file and better gradients or surface areas growing gradually finer and finer, then you're probably in a good spot. I mean, I just got mine from a art supply store. They're nothing special, but unfortunately my finest tipped file has recently broken somehow, and it's now a big chunky boy. So I do actually need to get another fine pointed file so I can continue to do that work with something which is actually fit for purpose. A mold line remover is something kind of like a file, is good for cleaning up, but I have a limited amount of time for mold line removers. I actually find that scalpels, when used the right way, actually do a better job than a mold line remover. Depending on how you hold and apply pressure on your scalpel, you can do a lot of damage to the plastic if you use it to scrape. But if you're really delicate, which will require a bit more muscle memory, when you're really delicate with your scalpels, they do virtually the same job as a mold line remover. And a mold line remover is probably good on large surfaces, but I definitely wouldn't use them for fine detail, just because they tend to be a bit too thick at the business end. And when the actual removing component of a remover is too thick to fit in a part of a model where you need it to fit to do its best work, well, then it's not useful as a tool. I have one. I rarely use it. It's good for large pieces of plastic, but otherwise I don't. But having one is handy should you ever need one. The next thing, which I think is really important, is having a decent hard rubber cutting mat, preferably with size guides. You can get these again from arts and crafts stores or from your hardware store, and just means that whatever surface you're working on isn't being completely destroyed by your modeling. I have a few paint specks on my desk from where I've been working, but a few specks of paint here and there is nothing compared to having big gouged holes from things like clippers and drills and all that sort of stuff. So having a piece of hard rubber in the way is always a good step towards not destroying your workspace. To that sort of similar theme, a pin vise or good drill is really good, together with a hobby saw, to work with harder materials in order to be able to employ finer materials. So an example of that being Games Workshop's pin vise, really good for drilling into a variety of materials, but I feel like the mechanism that clamps the drill bit in is probably, you know, one that breaks down a little bit too quickly. So there are probably other alternatives out there that you could use. However, for the most part, if you're mainly working with plastic, I think that the Games Workshop / Citadel pin vise is great, and has a variety of different bits that comes with it. So it's good for things like drilling out bolters or other spaces like that. However, things like hobby saws, you are better off using a Jules saw than the weird kind of tool that is available on Citadel, in the Citadel range, sorry. The interchangeable components rely on a fairly weak hub. And if you're using something like tin or copper or pewter, it's probably better to have a bit more leverage for your cuts, particularly if you're doing a lot of sawing with thicker components rather than something that's small, to reduce some of the stress that's on your wrist. So I always use a jeweler's saw for cutting those because they're better blades, there's more leverage, there's more control, and you can generally get a better result with that. And to the same end, I guess, I also have a Dremel. Having a Dremel or powered drill is a really handy tool to have if it's at the right scale. So I have a Dremel Micro, and the Dremel Micro comes with a large range of different drill bits or other attachments, which are really excellent for working with all kinds of materials. So all those bits combined with the Dremel Micro's good balance and weight and battery power and endurance, without this being, of course, a plug for Dremel, is also really handy. So a key example of these two things being distinguished is the Forge World Templar Brethren shoulder pad. The Templar Brethren shoulder pad is attached to an arm, and using the Dremel to get in there and remove the arm from the shoulder pad is made a lot easier with the right attachment onto the Dremel Micro, so it's great for that. If you're not looking to make a very straight and fine cut, then a Dremel is perfectly fine for you to tidy up thereafter with another file. However, for something like the Metal Inquisitor Demon Hunter, I've used both the straight edge jeweler's saw for parts of the trimming back and cutting of this particular model, but I'll also be using a Dremel and my files to go back on that and tidy it up to achieve the look I'm looking for, as well as clipping off the rectangular base plate with the name that's kind of sits on the bottom there with my Trojan clippers. However, as I was mentioning earlier, because they have a pointed blade that's angular, I'll need to go back and tidy that up. But these are made a lot easier with the right tools. I do feel that with the right third-party tools, you're going to get a great result. Maybe you'll be able to get the same outcomes with Citadel, but I just haven't had the experience with them that suggests that is, you know, as possible. Without you know, trying to shit on Games Workshop too much, some of their products, you know, I'm looking at you, Flamer, Airbrush. They could be made a bit better. So by all means, if you're just starting out and doing less sophisticated projects, the Games Workshop tools are fantastic for those. But if you're intending on doing something a bit more heavy duty, make sure you have the tools that are there to do the right job. And when you're using powered tools like these and harder materials that imply fragmentation and splitting and things like that, and particularly a high-powered spinning blade or drill bit, the use of PPE, such as dust mask and gloves and safety glasses, is really important together with your cutting mat. And always using those tools in spaces where there's good light and air ventilation and noise insulation is key. Or if you're doing that in a space or at home where you've got other people living there who might get a little annoyed with the sound of your power tools, it's always a great idea to have a good insulation from noise, but also making sure that you're not leaving resin dust or shreds of pewter around common spaces, and vacuuming up all those once you're done, I think is really important, because you might live in a house where there are small animals or small children who might be really seriously harmed by coming into contact with some of these, particularly if you've cut a part of a model which has left a sharp edge. You know, children tend to poke and play around with things and put them in their mouths, and you don't want a child consuming pewter or anything like that. So be wary of your workspace. Make sure it's optimized for what you're doing. Use PPE for instances where you're using tools that might involve large blades or materials such as metals or resin, which can be harmful. And make sure you're doing what you're doing in a space with good light and ventilation, so that firstly, you can see what you're doing, but you're also not exposing yourself to any more harm than is necessary to get the outcome you're looking for. That's what I want to touch on from a tools perspective, as it relates to the cutting and trimming and filing back of different components of models. However, there is just one more segment for this episode that focuses on the sculpting and correction of models that I'll jump to in just a moment. So we'll take a very short break and then we'll jump back to modeling and sculpting. Welcome back to season one, episode two of Slam Hammer, on the basics of hobbying and modeling. And what I wanted to touch on in this last segment is something very near and dear to my heart, which is sculpting to meet a desired aesthetic. For this segment, I'm going to be using my Inquisitor Demon Hunter model as a point of reference to explain what I'm talking about. I'm currently holding a relatively old Inquisitor Demon Hunter model, and for those who are interested in what that actually might be, it's the Inquisitor Demon Hunter model, which carries a combi weapon in his left hand, is holding a sword pommel with a weapon facing down in his right hand, and has an inquisitorial eye crest on the back of his armor with a bionic eye. The idea behind this particular model is to create a Ordo Xenos Crusader, even though that model doesn't exist in the lore or in the rules, purely because I think it looks cool. And this guy is going to count as Gottfried de Montbard from Blackstone Fortress. And the idea is that this Inquisitor Demon Hunter, save for one book icon, which sits on this model's left shoulder and can be readily translated to any kind of Inquisitor without much difficulty, it's going to be translated to an Ordo Xenos model, because there's very little else that actually ties it to the Ordo Malleus. But to get that model to sit within my desired aesthetic, there are a few changes that need to be made. First, to the arms, because the arms are set in such a way that they are holding weapons in a particular way, and I want to have something else going on with that. But I also want to change the head. And if you look at this model closely, it has a very large hooded pewter head with a, let's say power or data cable running from the back of the inquisitorial crest to the side of the head. So a few things need to change about this model if you want to have an inquisitor well equipped to utilize psychic powers through the psychic hood to the point where it actually becomes more like a crusader with no such psychic capacity in exchange for a little bit extra badassery. And the way that you need to go about correcting a model once you've removed various components, and at this stage I've removed the substantive part of the left arm and I've removed most of the right arm with a jeweler's saw, is through the use of green stuff. And a lot of people will use green stuff or milliput or other epoxy putties to gap fill their models. And there are a few models where that gap filling is necessary, unfortunately, because the joins don't meet up quite as well as they really should. But when you start to move from that basic gap filling to creating something which is unique and special, being able to craft new details onto a model is a really good step and adds a new level of creativity to what you can actually come up with, because you're not restrained by any of the physical dimensions of the model and you're not restrained by what's available in plastic kits. So green stuff and milliput, I have both, but I mostly use green stuff for my details unless something super fine is required. Milliput white is optimized for super fine details that you're sculpting, and accordingly it is employed for that purpose, but you wouldn't waste it on gap filling because it's not ideal for that, whereas green stuff for most people is going to be fine for most projects. Once you've started to employ green stuff and epoxy putties like milliput, getting a good finish with these products is a byproduct of the right combination of the two parts. So in this case, with green stuff being a yellow part and a green part, to achieve the right malleability and setting, setting nature. So is it going to set quickly or is it going to set slowly? But also being able to smooth out your work so that, for example, if I want to extend the cape or any of the robes on this Inquisitor Demon Hunter, that might require a smoother finish than might be available through simply smoothing with a modeling tool. And a good smoothing agent, which you can pick up from basically anywhere, is petroleum jelly, like Vaseline. And using a smoothing agent to refine your work helps you achieve a very nice result with your green stuff rather than a grainy or rough edge on the end of whatever you're sculpting. So, for example, some people might sculpt some robes or a tabard on their models, and you can really tell where that work has been rough because the edges of that green stuff work is quite dicey. If you compare that with a modeler who uses a good consistency of green stuff and a very light green color, but almost having a blue tinge to it, and using a smoothing agent, it's often very silky almost. And you can't see the individual creases or dents or bubbles or anything like that in the work because they've taken the extra time, the extra effort to make that look really good. So I would certainly recommend investing not only in a good product like green stuff, but also in a good smoothing agent so that your work is of a fine quality. Once you've got your green stuff or your milliput, being able to work it appropriately is, as you can expect, pretty key. And the right sculpting tool makes a big difference. So for a lot of people, they'll be able to use the normal Citadel tools and they're okay, but I don't use them. What I use is a product suite from Green Stuff World, they have a very extensive professional modeling kit, which has 10 tools in it and comes in a leather case. They're based in Europe and they ship relatively well. Again, not a paid plug, but that's where I get my tools from. And they've been really great for basic putty work. And if you don't want to order from Europe, then there are Australian equivalents, which are available, and they're fine. And you can also get clay working tools from arts and hobby shops like Riot Arts and Crafts, and they will achieve substantially the same result. For some of the finer or more difficult work that involves peculiar angles, what I use is dental tools. And one of the benefits of having a partner who works in that industry is that she has a bit of an insight into what tools might be effective. And dental tools are also available through similar channels, not through Riot Arts and Crafts, of course, but there are resellers of these tools. And what these allow you to do is work green stuff on a difficult angle. And a good example of this is in between an arm and a cape, if you're looking to fill a gap. With a long, straight-edged green stuff working tool, it might be difficult to get behind an arm to work green stuff into a gap like that. But with dental tools, a lot of these tools are fundamentally designed to work in difficult areas and around sets of teeth or gums to either apply a filling or sculpt a crown or anything like that. So what I would also recommend if you intend on working on difficult angles is also getting a set of some basic dental tools. The amount of smoothing that you're able to achieve through the use of a good dental tool in areas such as neck crevices, so where you would apply a model's head and neck. So when you think about a space marine, they've got that ribbed neck, which you insert on top of the model. Being able to work in there, there are some really great dental tools which do fantastic work in those spots and can really allow for some fantastic results depending on what you're going for. So when it comes to this Inquisitor Demon Hunter, which I'm converting, he's going to have his head removed with a Dremel because it is surplus to my requirements and not exactly what I'm looking for in the head of my Auto Xenos Crusader. And then a new head we placed in that gap. But inside that gap where the head's been removed, be green stuffing and sculpting the rest of the neck and the cloak and the shoulder and neck armor with these dental tools to achieve the right result. And when you're sculpting, there are typically two ways that you can approach it. You can have a green stuff or milliput combination, which is lighter, including more of the modeling component, which is a lighter component for green stuff, a bright yellow. And that is very easy to work, but takes a long time to set. And that's why there is a blue setting component. The blue setting component is the component which I prefer to have a little bit more of. I like to have a modeling putty which does what it's told and also doesn't take forever to set. In any case, you should be leaving your finished work for around about 24 hours for it to set. But the more malleable the modeling putty is, the more likely that it's going to distend or distort through a normal working process. And if you're working on fine details, you need things to stay once you finish them. So you will achieve a level of combination which works for you through experience. And it's not something you can necessarily be taught because it comes down to your personal preference and your muscle memory and your fine motor skill around the use of these sculpting tools. However, my preference is for slightly more setting agent. So my green stuff will come across as a little bit bluer than normal, whereas some people's might be a bright green. And that's entirely up to them. It comes down to how they like to work with tools and how easily they like to work their putties, or if they like to achieve a finer detail look or something which is a bit more basic. The more basic the design, the less of the blue setting agent to harden green stuff you'll need, because you don't require the finer details there, and thus a harder, more workable putty is not required. You can work with an easier, more malleable putty combination, but you will need to leave it a little bit longer. When you're working with these modeling putties, you can get it underneath your fingernails, and it can dry out your skin. So one thing I like to wear when I'm working with green stuff or milliput is examination gloves. And the examination gloves which I have are from a seller called Black Panther. Black Panther sells gloves for tattoo artists. And the reason why I like to wear these black polyurethane gloves or latex gloves rather than the latex gloves that you can buy from the supermarket is that the latex gloves from the supermarket, they don't sit as snugly. They don't fit like a glove. And they leave my hands feeling sweaty and gross afterwards, even though they do have the powder on the inside to absorb moisture. I don't quite like them. So I like a snug fit, and I like the texture of those gloves as well because they are somewhat more appropriate for use with tools, and that's evidently what you're doing when you're working green stuff with these tools as well. So you get a bit better grip and just overall better. And if you get dry skin, wearing examination gloves or, you know, if it comes to a pinch, the latex gloves that you can get from the supermarket, and you also keep that material off your skin, and then you don't have to spend time, you know, using things like moisturizers and all that kind of stuff to get the moisture back in things like the tips of your fingers or your knuckles, depending on what you're doing. And I occasionally get dry skin on my knuckles, and I find that the more that I wear examination gloves when I work, the less effort I need to put into reconstituting the moisture in my skin. So I'd also recommend that, particularly if you have eczema or other skin conditions which might result in some dryness. While you're working with green stuff, it's not a toxic. It's not a toxic composition in the same way that other cleaners are, but I would still recommend working in a space with good ventilation and light, light especially. And the reason for that is if you're trying to create fine details with something which is soft and malleable, being able to see what you're doing is really important. And that is more so when you're working in difficult areas. So be sure that you're working in a space which is bright and airy, and take your time with it. Time is a component of the hobbyist tool set, which I've not spent too much time on over the course of this podcast episode. And it's actually far and beyond the most important of anything that I've mentioned aside from a notepad pen. Taking a good amount of time to focus on what you're doing and deliberatively work on your models is a surefire way to achieve a great result, whereas rushing, unless you are able to do this kind of stuff in your sleep, leads to mistakes. And for the most part, I like to think I'm pretty good with all these sculpting and modeling and crafting activities. But at the same time, I do like to take my time and quite slowly and deliberatively work, because I appreciate that it can be quite difficult to get a good result in an instance where I am short on time, or I'm stressed, or there's something creating a level of anxiety or discomfort. So make sure you're comfortable when you're doing it. Make sure you're not pressed for time. Often working with modeling putties requires time to get exactly the right result that you're looking for and to get the right shape. Once you start speeding things along, you tend to make mistakes. And when you make mistakes with putties, you can correct them, but they tend to be relatively unforgiving. When you're working with modeling tools such as knives and scalpels and Stanley knives, all those sorts of things, and particularly with Dremels, with cutting blades, Also employing safe cutting methods alongside taking your time is evidently going to be a way which you avoid injury. Practice using your blades and make sure that your blades are sharp. A blunt blade and trying to force a blunt blade is a really great way to injure yourself. And I was unlucky enough to lose the very tip of my left thumb back in 2003 when I did try to force a scalpel when I was removing parts from the sprue of a Space Marine Predator. So there are also various wounds from trying to force a scalpel through pewter back in the day when I was first learning about converting, and at a time where pewter models were a bit more common, particularly in the Warhammer range. So do be extremely careful when working with blades. It should be fairly easy and straightforward for most of you. However, you know, I do want to emphasize that particularly where you work around smaller children and animals, the residue or mess or offcuts that you create through your modeling process are ones which small children and animals might try and pick up or play with or eat. And of course, you don't want to be taking a child or an animal to a vet or hospital emergency facility trying to remove a shard of pewter or a blade or anything like that from their digestive tract. It's probably not ideal. Secondary to that is using PPE. And PPE is really important when working with pewter because it can be so unforgiving if you make a mistake. PPE like safety glasses when you're clipping metals is a really good step. Particularly with his Inquisitor Demon Hunter, when I was clipping away parts of the left arm, I was wearing my safety glasses and using my Trojan heavy-duty clippers rather than something from Citadel, because they are designed to do that work. And once I have pulled out my Dremel, I'll be doing exactly the same thing with the safety glasses and with a dust mask, because you'll be pulverizing this soft metal and you don't need to be breathing any of that in. Once you're done with working with these kinds of materials, and if it involves cutting or clipping or filing or sanding or anything like that, be sure to vacuum up the residue, particularly when you're using something like a resin component or model, because resin can be harmful to breathe in. And if it's harmful for you, it's going to be harmful for everybody else who is around you, because they're probably not the ones wearing PPE. And you don't need a child or a small animal exposed to resin dust, because they are going to be more susceptible to damage. The final point for this whole episode is to not take yourself too seriously or the modeling project too seriously, especially when you're starting out. Basic work is what you should be starting off on, and don't get discouraged if things don't work out. It's part of the creative process. It's part of the learning process. You will not get things right all the time, and I've made countless mistakes when learning how to employ new methods. So focus on what the end outcome is, plan your work, take your time, do it in an appropriate environment in an appropriate way, and see how you go. But if you are stuck, and if you do want some advice as to how to approach the topic of a particular conversion, be sure to ask. There are entire hobbying communities out there who can be a great start, and the whole reason why Crossblade Studios is on Instagram, not only to show off work and to keep people posted on progress, is also so people can ask questions. So if you do have questions about a modeling project you are working on, be sure to contact us at Crossblade Studios on Instagram and via email, crossbladestudios@gmail.com. You can also ask a question through the voice messaging link in our anchor.fm profile, so be sure to use that too. I would love to discuss all this sort of thing a lot more with listeners, so do be sure to use that opportunity to get some real-time feedback, and if not real-time, at least some timely feedback. So thank you very much for your time again. If you do have any feedback on this episode in general, be sure to use the same messaging channels to relay that. I look very forward to catching you next time, where we'll be doing a focus on the basics of painting and color. And look forward to seeing you then. So have a great day, everyone.